Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 234th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Saint Hope and Grace Watch Media. I'm Matt Emo.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and today we have the cinematographer Benedict Spent, who shot Netflix's End of the Effing World Season 2, among many other things. And we have like a wonderful, wonderful chat. We don't talk to a lot of cinematographers because, you know, they're boring usually, but Benedict.
Yeah. It was great. It was so fun. I think
I learned a lot.
I learned a lot as well, and it was just, it's maybe our most technical episode in a way that was really fun. So if you're interested in the art of cinematography, and most importantly, I think we talk a lot about the rules that a cinematographer and director make for themselves, a philosophy to create the look of a show. And that's a thing that I think we talk about a lot on our show, on the podcast, but I think this is the most nitty-gritty on specifically what it means to create a philosophy that guides the look of the show. And if you look at season 2 of End of the Effing World, all of those things come into play. Every single frame looks specifically only like End of the Effing World season 2. And also it's informed by the way in which they, you know, they're basing it off a graphic novel that's very elemental, very basic, very graphic. So how do you put that into real terms? I think, Oren, in the episode, you say, well, like, yeah, it's easy to just like look at a comic book and be like, oh, we're going to make it comic booky. But what does that literally mean?
Yeah, we recorded this a few weeks ago, and I have a confession to make, which is I stole some of the rules for something I shot since then because I was just so excited. And when I say rules, when we talk about rules with Benedict, it's not like, oh, you should always do this or you should always do this. It's when you come up with a set of rules for your show. So specifically the rule that I really like that they talked about that I also try to do in something is to shoot all the coverage of the characters within the dialogue, is how Benedict put it, you know, where you put the camera, basically clean singles, where the camera is as if it's between the two characters, not behind one of the characters, and center punching them, you know, because there's, you get kind of this like Coen Brothers, like wide angle, comedic, center punched, clean single look. And I did it. And I think you can feel it.
Yeah, great, man.
I don't know if that's killed it, but I do have a big weakness for overs. I think the reason an over-the-shoulder shot is so nice is because it gives you geography, it ties two characters together, and most importantly, it gives you a foreground element to create like a layered composition. And so shooting clean is always scary to me because I feel like I'm taking away some of the things that might distract you. You know, and create a prettier shot.
So what I'm hearing, so there's not anything inherently good or bad about clean or inside, right? But what I'm hearing is that you took the rules that we talked about in this episode and forced yourself to reassess the habits that you have as a filmmaker and decide which ones you wanted to break for this specific project, which is what I think maybe listeners could do as well. Look at that. This is a teachable moment. Right. Talk about the rules. Think about it. There's not a right or wrong way to do most of the things we're talking about. If everything's exposed correctly, quote unquote, or whatever, that you, and it's the right speed, that's kind of it, right? But reassessing why you shoot the way you shoot and then making a conscious decision to shoot that way or a different way is something that we could all benefit from doing a little bit more. And this conversation helped you do that. I bet it could help listeners at home as well.
Yeah. Practice stuff. And you have to commit. That's the problem. Because even while we were shooting, I was like, would an over look nicer? Or would a longer lens be better? It would kind of blur out the background more. And then we wouldn't have to worry about the art direction there. And then, you know, we would see the other character's shoulder, but it would be nice. But I just had to be like,
Benedict was on one shoulder and a blurry shoulder of an actor in the foreground was on your other shoulder. That's the devil and the angel in this situation for you, Aaron.
Yeah, but no, this is a really enlightening conversation we had with Benedict. I'm very excited for people to listen to it. And I even told the cinematographer I work with a lot about it. And he keeps asking me when it's coming out. And the answer is today.
Well, before we get into our conversation with Benedict, we do have to remind everyone that we have a Patreon. Patreon.com/justshootitpod is the place where you can throw us a buck or two if you want to support the show in some way. We've got a lot of expenses out there. We've got a little bit of marketing I'm spending money on now. We've got hats to buy for people, stickers to buy for people, shipping to buy for people, and then also, of course, paying our team who dedicates so much of their time to making things happen. You'll notice in our show credits now we've got a new person, Derek Aiello, is there to help us out. He's getting the social media out in a bigger, better way so that we can be more dependable, more consistent, make sure that you are up to date on what is happening on the show. And thanks to your help on Patreon, Derek is a part of the team now.
I know. I've noticed Derek has been tweeting all my endorsements, and now I'm like, oh, I should probably think a little bit more about those endorsements before I give
them. Look at that. That is a way that Derek is making our show better.
The feedback mechanism is making me a better host so that he doesn't tweet out bad things that I say.
Yeah, things that aren't just in your living room.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm ready for endorsements. I'm going to endorse Dirty Dishes. Awesome. Well, thanks everyone for helping us out. Patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's the equivalent of buying us a coffee or maybe paying, I don't know, 99 cents an episode, something like that.
And if you give us $10, you will get a free Just Shoot It podcast hat, which I've seen Carlin Hudson has been wearing all over the place and just getting jobs left and right. I think there is a connection.
I think it makes you a little cooler. Roxy's shooting something as well, and I bet you $1 million she's got that hat with her.
I might take that bet. We'll say I gotta text someone first.
Without further ado, let's talk to Benedict Spence.
Hey folks, we're interrupting this incredible episode of the podcast to tell you about a new sponsor that we're working with, Front Row Insurance Brokers. One of the challenges of being a filmmaker is that there's a lot of risks that we take, and we really just want to focus on making good stuff. So what if there was a company that could take those risks, manage them for us while we are being artists?
That's right. Front Row Insurance Brokers arranges film production insurance to cover the risks associated with your production. They cover features, TV shows, documentaries, commercials, music videos, webisodes, basically anything you can watch on big, medium or phone-sized screens.
Yeah, Front Row will help you focus on your artistic vision by transferring all the risks to them and minimizing your production hazards. And they cover any budget from $2,000 all the way up to $200 million. There's nothing that's too small or too big.
If you are shooting in Canada, use coupon code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF for $50 off your film production insurance. That's promo code JUSTSHOOTIT50OFF to save $50.
And if you're shooting in the U.S., that same code can be redeemed offline by mentioning it to a broker, by email, or over the phone.
It's like a cool password if you're in the U.S. That's Just Shoot It 50 off.
Check them out. Let us know how it goes. You're with us from London, right?
Yes, I am. Yeah, from East London. Yeah, thank you for the invite.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, Benedict, let's jump into the end of the fucking world, right?
Yes.
Because you had been kind of gigging around for a long time before that. End of the fucking world, you know, it's such an accomplishment, right? We were talking off mic about how it's kind of like the goal, right? Like to do a cool, like, indie Netflix show with its own look and feel, and that's kind of zeitgeisty, you know, is a big deal, right? So how did you go about tackling something that was originally a graphic novel and had its own visual identity? How do you kind of jump into that world?
Yeah, I mean, it was an absolute dream of a job to be given. I mean, who doesn't want to get a cool Netflix show like The End of the Effing World to shoot? Yes, I mean...
Before we actually get into like the nitty-gritty of how you shot it, like how did you get the job?
I got the job because of my good friend and director, Lucy Forbes. I've been working with her for 12 or 13 years. And she, like me, comes from a sort of a factual entertainment background. So like a sort of reality TV background. And we did a little pilot called In My Skin, which we shot in the summer of 2018. And then that was released. And off the back of that pilot, which is a BBC comedy series, and she went for the interview, went for another interview, got the job, and then got me in the room for a meeting about it. And I managed to lie enough to trick all the producers into letting me shoot it.
You know, it's funny actually, because I feel like a lot of our good friends who made that jump, right, when they were maybe shooting, you know, commercials and music videos and their own passion projects and short films and stuff, everybody's got like a DP or two that they love and they want to bring along with them. But we've seen instances where, you know, the reel doesn't pass the mustard for producers or, you know, whatever big fancy suit there is. And they're like, no, we really want to bring in an outside person to come collaborate.
I mean, I'll be totally honest with you. I didn't think I was going to get the job. You know, I didn't think I was one of those sort of super cool hip DOPs. And I still don't think I am. You know,
I'm drinking beer. That's pretty cool.
But yes, I am. It is. I like to think drinking is very cool.
A warm British beer, though?
No, an ice cold American beer, in fact. So certainly, I mean, you can talk to my agent if you want. I was, for the first time ever, I was sort of cut up about this job because I went for an interview. I was like, oh my God, they're not gonna get me to do it. I'm not one of these cool hip DOPs. You know, it's very nice of Lucy to get me in the room. You know, I just haven't got the name. I'm not cool. I'm not one of this, that, and the other. And I think Lucy gave him a little prod, and yeah, I got it. But yes, certainly, you know, almost any other show, almost any, you know, so the show is so cool and it's so loved, you know, almost any other show, and I wouldn't have given quite as much of a shit. But yes, I was exceptionally lucky that I had my good friend Lucy pushing for me.
Do you think that was the decision factor, like the reason that you got?
I mean, to think it was my prior work on MTV, Pimp My Ride. Certainly, you know, yeah, she, I mean, without Lucy, without my friend, director Lucy Forbes, I would not have ever been in the room in the first place.
Did you have other scripted material, or like we joke about Pimp My Ride and all that stuff, but you had to have had some other?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd sort of worked on mostly comedy series for about sort of 6 years beforehand. I'd done a couple of dramas, nothing major.
Well, In My Skin, I just kind of watched the trailer of it, and it has very much that, it, like a lower budget look of End of the Fucking World, right? The coverage, the casting, the overcast lighting, which I know is just like a British thing.
Yeah, very much so.
But it has that very similar feeling. But if you look at End of the Fucking World, it's just kind of that plus like a polish and like a color contrast that seems like you had more control over your environment.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you know, sort of In My Skin, the job which got Lucy the gig, The End of the Fucking World, and the job which I guess in turn got me the gig. Yeah, I mean, I think really the big thing that we did for that show specifically was to create a rule book, was to create a sort of a show Bible, which I'd never done before. And for In My Skin, we had some very strict rules about how we work out coverage and what lenses we would use for certain shots and people.
And who writes these books? Is it you or is it Lucy? Or
that's me with Lucy as well. So, you know, if it's a visual thing, I'm there writing it, but the rules are decided between the two of us.
Dude, Matt, did you look? So Benedict sent us the End of the Fucking World 2 guidebook, specifically not a rule book, and it's quite amazing. Did you look at this yet, Matt? Did you open it up?
Unfortunately, we can't share it with listeners.
Sorry.
No, can we read some excerpts from it, though?
Yeah, please do. Be my
Can
guest.
Can we do a staged reading at the local bookshop?
You're welcome to read some excerpts if you want.
There's just two pages. Like, if we could just dig into these two pages. Sorry, we're getting so nitty-gritty right from the top, but you have on a page titled Central Framing. Please frame left to right centrally. Crosshairs, bang on, faces, props, locations, exceptions for in-car work. We'll talk about that in a different document. But so that sounds a little British, this crosshairs, bang on, faces. Do you mean center punching?
Oh, I don't know what that means, but I assume you mean putting someone right on the middle of the camera crosshairs, you know, a little cross in the middle of the camera, which not everyone uses, but I do. And yeah, the character bang on, meaning exactly there. that's definitely a colloquialism.
So when you say bang on faces, props, locations, does that mean if it's just an empty room, it's perfectly centered in the frame?
Yeah, conceivably. I mean, it's not necessarily, but I mean, it's rare that we would have an empty room with nobody in it in the show. And obviously all this is exactly why I crossed out rule book at the top of the document and put guide, because you can't have rules for every single situation. But yeah, certainly centralized framing is an obvious and page one of the rule book rule, and that certainly is one of the things which we very much took from the first series, which in turn took that from the graphic novel.
Okay, so a lot of the inspiration of this framing comes from that graphic novel.
It does, yeah. I don't know if you've read it. It's this sort of minimalist masterpiece. It's absolutely brilliant, sort of line drawing stuff, and there's almost nothing to it. Just like the show, the show is minimalist almost to the point of abstraction. There's not many props, there's not much lighting, there's not much camera movements. All that is stripped away.
Right, but there's so much texture, and gradations and tonality and stuff. And
absolutely. So Lucy and my sort of high concept view of the show is, on one hand, a sort of a ultra minimalist graphic novel, but somehow mixed in with a sort of a 90s Coen brother-esque road movie shot, sort of early Roger Deakins type thing. So sort of somehow combining those two aesthetics is kind of, and gets you the end of the effing world.
And everything feels so lived in, like the production design is like quite
the design
incredible.
Is brilliant. Yeah, Dick Lund did an amazing job on it.
So you have these very prescriptive rules that you kind of outline very clearly that I imagine are inspired by the graphic novel itself. So like things that we're looking at, they're very specific. It's things like Oren, like zero tilt, right? So like,
right. Yeah. So you have a whole list of things, and we thought maybe it would be fun to go through them. So it's easy to say like this comes from the graphic novel, but I think I'd love to hear, and I think our listeners would love to hear, like kind of what that accomplishes, like emotionally or tonally or visually.
And I think how it makes it feel like a graphic novel. Right, I think your point is right, Oren. It's like easy to be like, oh, make it comic booky, but what does that mean, especially to something that's so specifically evocative? So let's run through them real quick, Oren. Walk us through.
Yeah, so zero tilt. Whenever possible, keep the camera on zero tilt unless you really need to show a certain perspective. So what does that mean? The camera's always level?
The camera's always level. Yeah, there's a few shots where it's not, but I'd say sort of 95% of the shots are without any tilt in the camera.
Okay, cool. So coverage, about coverage, you say shoot within the dialogue. Don't shoot over the shoulders, which I find it's a guideline that I'm always interested in doing in my work. But then at some point I'm like, oh, the shoulders just look so good. Like, let me, and they kind of make a crappy shot like slightly less crappy because they're giving you a free foreground element.
Absolutely, a little bit of depth there. Yep.
Yeah. Next, you have no establishers. Please don't use establishers unless there's a serious action or information contained within them. Don't even shoot the buggers.
Yep.
Ooh, don't even shoot, that's an interesting rule for, the BBC is kind of its own thing, but for a network show, like not shooting a piece of coverage like that. And then if you got like a studio executive to be like, oh, we don't know where we are, shoot the log cabin or whatever.
I did notice all the establishing shots looked like iStock stock photo shots or iStock. stock.
Yeah, there's a Pond 5 watermark in there.
Okay, then don't move the camera during dialogue. Of course, not including Steadicam walking and talking scenes, which there are a lot of, right? They're walking down the street, they're walking there, mm-hmm. around.
But you can still... You could carry that sort of ethos into a walk and talk as well, right? There's a difference
between... The camera is staying the same distance from the actors,
right?
Is kind of another way to say that. Minimize operating. Whenever possible, try not to pan and tilt the camera, especially when Benedict has been drinking that day.
I spent most of my time on the series not touching the camera. I would put it on zero tilt, chuck it and lock it off. Very little operating, often to the detriment, to be honest. I think there's a couple of times where I could have panned over a little bit to have contained someone, but...
Well, you kind of have little side note here. This is sometimes impossible without affecting performances, so don't worry about it too much, which I like, and I think... That is a thing where a lot of times you are kind of pitching this idea of like a static camera shot, but the actors, you don't want to stop them from doing the things that they feel like they should do.
Absolutely not. No, we're here for them. I'm there for them, not vice versa. So yeah, absolutely. What they want to do is priority.
Did you ever do the thing of like, making the shot say, a certain amount, a certain percentage wider than you needed, knowing that, like, hey, we're just going to crop in everything 10% or something and give yourself that wiggle room? No.
No, and there's a reason for that, and it'll be on a couple of pages' time on the rule book. I mean, I would say, you know, essentially those rules, that page of rules there is probably quite, you know, to a degree related to the graphic novel. I wouldn't say that we took those specifically visually from what the graphic novel does, the centralized framing perhaps, but really it's more sort of the graphic novel is so minimalist. That's what we wanted to take from it, was the minimalism, was to pull away all the little things you do. You know, you did putting looking space on one side or the other of a screen, you know, doing little slides in, all those things, just try to pull all those things out of it to create something which was minimalist. So rather than exactly visually mimicking the comic book, it was about pulling everything away. And I kid you not, that graphic novel is incredibly minimalist. So, yeah, and that was the reason for sort of the majority of those rules on that page, was to minimize what we do. I mean, I think probably now is a good time to say, actually, the rules serve a couple of purposes. One gives the show style, which is obvious. You know, if it's always centrally framed, that's a style point. But actually, weirdly enough, they actually, I found, I didn't know this before, they actually helped with creativity. They actually, you know, made us more creative within the confines of the rules that we set. And be little tiny things, you know, like sort of framing for a space where nobody's there. There's a couple of shots with Alyssa and James on either side of the screen, and then in the middle you're centered on the space where, you know, where they're not. So, you know, so there are ways to really use that. And also, to be honest, it's sort of, you know, you spend, you know, just say you've got a 10-hour shoot day, and if you add up all the time you spend in that shoot day talking about where to place the character on the screen, left or right, it's probably 20 minutes of shoot time or 20 minutes of talking time, you know, throughout the day. So actually getting rid of a few things like that weirdly opens you up to be able to discuss a few other things a bit more, because obviously there's always a schedule and there's always a limit to the length of day. So actually all of these sort of rules, rather than constricting creativity, they actually allowed creativity to flow and in flow in different places as well.
What I love about that also, before you start a show or before you start a big project, you kind of are in this world where you're like, well, let's set up the rules. Let's give ourselves a guidebook. And Oren and I always joke about how quickly sometimes some of those grandiose ideas fly out the window, right? But with this in particular, I think that you have to stick to those rules pretty rigidly, because otherwise what is style can just look like low budget or unintentional filmmaking, right? If you don't really stick to that stuff, then all of a sudden the sweater becomes unraveled, right? If you tear it enough of those threads. And so did you ever in the moment think to yourself, ah, boy, maybe this isn't going to look cool. Maybe we should move the camera.
I wish we had some circular track.
Yeah, you know, like that's the extreme version, right? But it would be easy to get in the back of your head and be like, oh, is this just boring and not cool? You know,
absolutely. I totally agree. You know, you definitely want to sort of, there was plenty of times where you wanted to throw some stuff at it. But
yeah.
You know,
shoulder up, guys. Let's do it. Yeah.
But I essentially made a pact with Lucy at the start of the show, which was like, this rule book is it. This is the Bible. And unless we really, 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 really have to break these rules, we don't. And they definitely did the trick.
Yeah, I find myself when I'm making rules, like a lot of times it's time related. Then I'm like, well, my rule was that I don't move the camera, but if we just pan here, we'll get two shots in one and we're an hour behind and the sun's coming down, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Believe me, there's a number of times that it really made a rod for our own backs. It definitely, you know, they caused issues, those rules, believe me. But then, you know, things like, you know, it'd be rare that we'd shoot a wide shot of a scene because we wouldn't use wide lenses. And that was just, and that becomes part of a style. You know, there's how many times do you see a wide shot of, you know, people in the room? You never see a big wide of the location ever. The most you'll see generally is like a sort of profile two shot. And you know, and that feeds into the style massively. So yeah, they definitely gave us issues for sure. There's lots of annoyances and slowness occasional slowness from it, where exactly you just want to chuck on a zoom and go punch in, two shot quick, just do it quick.
Sure. Because hose it down, right?
Exactly, hose it down, because that's where we are. But there was a lot of time saving because of the rules as well. So that we definitely got that back.
Right. What did you shoot on?
We shot on the Arri Alexa LF, the large format Arri Alexa, the big one.
Interesting. And so let's talk about why you didn't give yourself a little bit of that wiggle room, that extra 10% for a punch-in.
Especially if you're shooting LF.
LF, yeah.
What's the resolution?
4.5K open gate. So I think it was pretty much bang on 4K when we take a 6x9 crop. I mean, I guess we could have given ourselves a bit of wiggle room. I mean, there's a couple of reasons in there. Number one is we had a very strict selection of lenses. Again, with this minimalist hat on, that was a 35, a 50, and a 65 mil lens. Now, we had a full complement of lenses, but that's what we used 99% of the show.
35, 50, and 65.
Yes, which roughly equates to, in Super 35 terms, a 27, 32, and a 40. So it's very middle of the range. There's nothing very wide in there, and there's nothing very long in there. You know, you're right in the middle of the range. And again, with this sort of minimalist hat on, you know, you don't have extreme wide lenses and you don't have extreme long lenses in that set. So nothing in the show really has got a wide angle lens on it.
Because there's a lot of action in the show. I mean, there's, you know, murdering and things going on.
Yep. And there's plenty of times you just go, oh, fucking hell, I wish I had a wide lens on.
But that's kind of fun, because sometimes when you do have that 16 mil and you're like, ooh, this could be interesting, or you have the 135, you're like, this could be interesting.
Yeah, you just saying that out loud is time wasted, right? That's kind of what your point is.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
You got three lenses. You best choose one of them. And again, all this is, you know, to bring the minimalism of the graphic novel, to nod towards this minimalist aesthetic. Nothing's super long. Nothing's super wide.
It's interesting that you didn't do, like, you know, a wide, a medium, and a long lens, right? That you chose kind of three medium-ish
three
lenses.
Bang in the middle. They're not indistinguishable, but they're fairly indistinguishable.
And what lenses were they?
They were Zeiss Supreme Primes.
Oh, cool. Are those special for that size sensor?
They're sort of Zeiss's, they're like the new Master Primes, but for full frame cameras. They're sort of, yeah, they're T1.5, so they're pretty fast. There's a good selection of them, and they're sort of, they're not quite as sharp as Master Primes. So there's a little bit more of a sort of filmic softness to them, just a little edge taken off them. So they've vignette loads well. I mean, normally that'd be a negative, but actually with a show where you centrally frame, it's a massive positive. So they were great.
And the show looks so filmic too.
Yeah, it does.
Like, how much of the color that we see in the final thing is done in the grade versus done by you?
I mean, it's all, you know, it's a little bit of everything, but certainly we got a colorist called Toby Tompkins, who did the first series, and we were lucky enough to get him he's one of the only people who came back on the second series, and he's brilliant and he's a genius, and you know, he really brings a lot, you know, technically and creatively. His sort of base grade, which he has got so many of his, I mean, I know nothing about grading really, but he's got millions of nodes, you know, like so many things.
Have you used Instagram
under that?
That's actually really pretty helpful.
On a camping trip this past weekend, and getting like things sent to my phone, these like Frame.io links to grade this commercial, and I was like, can we get like the blues like a little cooler, and then the color sent me something back, and the dark, you know, the black's a little cooler, and sends me back this thing, and everything looks cooler, and like now her skin, instead of kind of being warm, it feels like kind of pink. And I was like, no, I kind of meant more something like this. And I just like put it in Instagram.
Great.
And I was like, sorry, I'm so sorry that I'm doing this in Instagram, but just like more like this thing. But also like, and then for, you know, it's a commercial, it's not a Netflix show. So people are watching these things. It's a digital spot too. Like they are watching them on iPhone. So I feel like my monitoring is not exactly that wrong.
Also, like using the tools, I was making a joke before, but using the tools that you know to help communicate, like who cares really, you know?
Totally legitimate, I think. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, maybe the colorist.
Yeah. Over here on the other side of the zoom.
So to go back to your question of why we didn't crop in a little bit on a very high res sensor, you know, which we could easily have done, done a little bit of a crop. Essentially, I was really keen to use all the sensor. So when I was testing it, the LF was fairly new when we got it. We had Ari Rental in the UK give us a couple for a very good price. One as a backup, which we needed because the first one went down. And did a little bit of testing in it. And, you know, they say Ari suggests that the ALEV 4 sensor or whatever it is in the Alexa is best rated at 800 ISO. Obviously, you can go a little bit more than that, a little bit less than that, but it has a bit of an effect in the noise if you increase it. Essentially, so the normal Alexa sensor is sort of a little sort of 4x3 square like that, and the LF sensor is two of those next to each other. So essentially, you've got two sensors next to each other, so you've got double the number of pixels. So compared to a normal Alexa sensor, the LF sensor, when you output onto your screen of choice, essentially with the LF sensor, you've got double the number of pixels there. So in theory, you've also got, therefore, half the amount of noise. You've got half the noise floor of it. So sort of I tested and played with the camera and sort of realized that if you rated at 1600 ISO, which is you'll never see that noise at all. If you rated at 1600 ISO or even 2000 ISO, you won't notice the noise at all. But essentially what you're getting is another stop of highlight protection. So you're getting a whole nother stop. Like, and when you're talking, the sensor is, you know, 13, 14 stops latitude as it is. Another stop, when you're talking that many stops, is a huge amount more information in the highlights specifically. And so that's why I sort of didn't crop into that sensor at all, because I wanted to have every single pixel I could, so we didn't see the noise, so we could keep that highlight roll off. And so there was sort of a creative reason for sort of lens choice and being quite strict with that, but also technically really want to use every single pixel in that big old sensor.
And I bet this is one of the few Netflix shows that shoots on RE, right? Because they had the 4K mandate a while ago.
Is that the other reason that the LF?
Well, that's the reason I chose it in the first place. I mean, I'm not a big red fan. I used to have a red one many years ago. And it was a good disruptive force when it happens, but the cameras are a pain in the ass, and the way they handle highlights is abominable, and it doesn't help a DP at all because it just easily burns out highlights. Whereas the Alexa, you know, I don't think there's any magic behind it particularly. It just handles highlights really, really, really well and just really takes care of you. It's very filmic in the way it handles those highlights, really rolls them off. So I was like, yeah, let's use Alexa. Is there any way we can get a LF? Because it passes Netflix's 4K mandate. And yeah, luckily Ari in London, let's have one.
Just to kind of make sure that listeners are clued into what we're talking about here. Basically, up until, it sounds like this is the first example that we've heard of it.
It's an early one, yeah.
Netflix required that anything that was a Netflix original would be authored at 4K or higher, basically. They were trying to future-proof resolution so that whenever we have our giant TVs and they're all 4K or whatever, all of the stuff that they're streaming would still look great. Which wasn't the case, I think, for their acquisitions, but like for Netflix originals that they're, you know, they're sponsoring and making, they just want everything to be 4K. And so that meant that everything had to be shot more or less on Red or some other equivalent, and DPs would always shake their head and, you know.
I shoot everything on the Canon R5.
yeah, exactly.
8K.
Yeah, so there you go. Future-proof. It looks great. There's so much resolution. But so it's interesting to hear that this large format camera now passes the muster for what Netflix is requiring, basically.
It does, yeah. I mean, you know, and that's, I think that's specifically why Arri built it. You know, they, as far as I understand, they built it, yeah, specifically to pass that. There are rumors on the wind of a Super 35 sensor 4K Arri camera.
Yeah, that would be cool.
But who knows where that is. Personally, I quite like large format. I quite like the bigger sensor. I certainly like what it does when you rate it a bit higher sensitivities. I'm into it as it currently is, but let's see what they bring out in the future. But yes, certainly that it was Netflix requirements were a pain in the ass. I'm very lucky that we got the Alexa. Made my life a lot easier.
Can we talk just about two more things from this document, just because I just find it fascinating, and I think our listeners, especially ones that are familiar with the show, will be like, ooh, I want my show to look like that, so I'm going to follow all these rules. One of the things you wrote here about the lens selection is if we use zooms, we try to start or stop on a legal lens. So do you mean that before you zoom in or zoom out, you're starting and stopping at lenses that actually exist in your prime lens kit?
Exactly, yeah. So, and you know, we I think it was normally a start more than a stop, because it's easier to cue that up. So yeah, if we did a zoom, we would generally start on, you know, 35mm, 50mm, or a 65mm.
Right. And you wrote about zooming. We definitely like a zoom in don't throw too many of them in, but occasion they're fun, retro, and cool. Our loose rule is to use a zoom for when a character is in their thoughts, perhaps into a flashback, dream, or voiceover, which is a cool thing. I feel like zooms are kind of making a comeback a little bit.
Oh, man, yeah. Massive yeah, in comeback. A big way. Yeah.
Have you, I probably shouldn't talk about other shows, but have you seen I Know This Much Is True?
I haven't watched it yet.
Absolutely amazing. Loads of zooms in that. I cannot recommend that show highly enough.
Is that a Netflix show too?
I think it's HBO.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah,
I just borrowed it off the internet.
Sure.
But zooms are definitely back. You know, at the end of the effing worlds, and all sorts of other shows are using them a lot. They're very cool.
Can I ask? So oftentimes when you want the same sort of feeling as a zoom, before, you know, back in the day before people realized how cool they are, you would just do a dolly move, right? Was that ever part of the conversation? Did you ever say like, hey, let's just live on our primes. That's the rule. And let's go ahead and break the camera movement rule instead.
No, I mean, I think the show exists in a slightly weird, timeless, retro world. And I think that's really what the very occasional zoom use brings it, because zooms are definitely a retro thing to do. To be totally honest, they're probably also a lot quicker than getting the track out as well. The show is, I know it's it's actually not a Netflix show. So The End of the Effing World is a co-production between Channel 4 in the UK and Netflix in America. And so definitely this is not a violin moment, but you know, Netflix are, you know, have the infinite money cheat sorted, whereas Channel 4 are incredibly poor. And so the sort of the actual budget for the show, even it has to be matched 50-50 between two of them. So the budget's not huge and our schedule is actually quite quick. So we, any little workarounds like that, we chose, and you know, the zooms worked sort of, again, creatively, and it worked logistically, you know, it sped us up.
Wow. Yeah, man, this document is so amazing. Like just kind of talking about the color and your white balance and using actual practical tungsten lights, but keeping your camera rated for 5600 Kelvin. And then your blue hour at night, you're kind of shooting things bluer in the exteriors, but keeping them warm inside.
For me, it sort of goes back to, you know, what we did in terms of what we did with the white balance goes back to what I was saying about it. Sort of half of the look of a show being this sort of 90s film aesthetic, indie movie type thing. And I wrote it in the documents. So a lot of the time I would sort of put this sort of role-playing game cap on and be like, well, if I was shooting an indie movie and we only had, you know, 100 speed daylight stock, and we didn't have the time to money to light anything at all, what would this look like? And in fact, I kept the white balance on the camera locked to 5600 almost the entire shoot. We shot ProRes as well, not RAW, so it was locked into that. So tungsten light becomes very warm, fluorescent light goes a little bit green. You know, we almost never did a trick white balance, almost never white balanced anything to neutral, or change the white balance to affect the picture, just to keep this sort of filmic honesty, which I wanted it to be, you know, burnt in as part of a look. So yeah, and we did that by keeping the camera set to daylight the whole time.
That's so funny to me, because I feel like if you could travel back in time, you know, those DPs would be like, yeah, well, we splurged and got a couple other film stocks as well. You know, I didn't want everything to look like that. And so it's so interesting to kind of reverse engineer that sort of mentality. Let me ask, this is, I feel like, the most technical episode we've ever done, which is great, actually. It's a breath of fresh air. The ProRes to RAW decision. Can you explain that a little bit? Because I'm
money.
Oh, interesting.
Money.
Okay.
Yeah, money and posts and various things like that. There's lots of things. There's, you know, little compromises which had to be made along the way. You know, to get the good camera, you got to leave something else, and you know, so, and I'm always have to micromanage. And yeah, certainly it sort of essentially came to that.
So, what specifically? How are you saving money through recording to RAW ProRes rather than
it was
RAW?
A processing and post chat. But to be honest, we were sort of figuring out the rules, and I spoke to Toby Tompkins, colorist, about that plan. And you know, ultimately, if you're not going to change the white balance, you don't need to worry about shooting RAW, you know,
anyway. Sure.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, so it kind of felt all right. It didn't feel like a compromise particularly for me. Having said that, there's a couple of times where skin tones are a bit murky under tungsten light, and I wish there was a bit more less burnt in detail, to be honest. But you know, it worked.
Yeah, that's great.
And then at the end of your document, you have a bunch of references, a lot of them from the Coen brothers.
Indeed.
Which, why, they use really wide lenses, right, for their stuff.
I think they are a big fan of 27mm, I do believe, like 21 and a 27.
And a 32, I feel like, as well?
May well be. You know, so which feel like a sort of a fairly close match to ours in super 35 terms. Obviously, our lenses are, the numbers are bigger, the longer, but the, because we're on full frame, there's a slight difference in calculation.
So I have a, kind of two more big questions. One is
far away,
about kind of balancing comedy with darkness, because the show, while it's very dark and there is, it is kind of about the end of the world, there's some very funny parts to it and kind of ridiculous situations that these two kids find themselves in. And there is a little bit of that British dryness, you know, to it,
but if you looked at a frame, you wouldn't be like, oh, that's a funny show.
Right. But you also don't look at it. And maybe part of this is casting, you know, there's part of it feels real, very like likable and easy to connect to these characters. And it could be just their faces, you know, were there scenes where you're like, oh, this feels like a horror film too much, or this feels like a comedy too much. Like, is that something you had to balance, or is that not really something
you
thought
about?
No, it wasn't
too bad, to be honest. I mean, we got very lucky. We never once had, I mean, I think you hit on, you know, notes from the channel, from the broadcaster a little bit. We never had, and we, you know, Netflix is the best people for leaving us alone and letting us do our thing. So there were never any notes from them. They never said, make it less dark. They never said, have some more establishers in there. They really left us alone and trusted us, which is an amazing thing. I mean, you know, I hear, especially in North America, you hear horror stories of, you know, networks and channels getting really involved and, you know, sacking people left, right, and center because of whatever.
Sure. If you don't have a clean single in your American comedy, then you haven't done your job, basically, right?
For me, studio notes, I've never had them before because I've never done a big studio job, feel like sort of almost like commercials. When you shoot commercials, you get notes from a client. And you can never argue them. And then I find often they're against the creativity, which you're trying to do. In a commercial, you sort of understand them a little bit more. But from what I understand, sort of notes from a channel are not always the nicest thing to receive.
But when you were shooting for MTV, did they never say like, oh, this doesn't feel like MTV. This is too cinematic. Make it more zooms, more handheld, like more neon. Yeah,
that's not Pimp My Ride.
Funnily enough, but actually,
that's not pimped enough.
I totally forgot about this. I did, when I did the first series of UK Pimp My Ride back in 2004 or something like that. That dates me. There was actually an American team which came over, and they had a 30 or 40 page show bible of everything that you do in the show. You know, it's a shot of a guy in front of the car, or a girl in front of the car, and then this camera spins around the car, and then exhibit arrives. But yeah, MTV brought over a big show bible from the UK.
I would love to compare the End of the Fucking World bible to the Pimp My Ride bible, because it feels like they might literally be polar opposites.
I mean, you never know. I've totally forgotten about this thing. Maybe it's just embedded in my subconscious, and maybe the answer to all these questions is like, yeah, I just ripped it off of Pimp My Ride.
Yeah.
To go back to your question about comedy, though, most of my scripted experience is comedy. And in fact, a lot of my commercials experience is comedy as well. I don't think comedy has to be, there's a sort of view that comedy has to be really flat and has to be really bright. I definitely don't think it does. I think really with comedy, you've got to feel for the cast. You've got to be, you know, you've got to have empathy for the cast, and you've got to feel that whatever they're feeling. And you know, my job as DOP is to help aid that. You know, if you're feeling awkward, you know, use awkward lighting, use the awkward gel. If they're having a hard time, it's dark and moody. You know, I think that's totally fine. There is this definite view where comedy has to be, it's really sort of just put a big soft light above a lens and it's great. And anything you do other than that takes away from a comedy. There's a lot of people who think that these days still. And yeah, I definitely disagree with that.
Can I ask you about the like color for a second? So if, listeners, if you go to BenedictSpence.com, you can see a lot of Benedict stuff. And I'm just kind of scrolling through your commercial and promo work here. And in general, all your stuff, including the narrative stuff, the color palette just seems very controlled. Like, how much of that are you involved in? And do you have any kind of general strategies of like how you approach color in a way that things feel vibrant or like real, but also have a look and a feel and a style to them?
My honest answer actually for commercials work is, I mean, I love references. You know, is I will sit down with the director and I will go through, I've got, you know, 10,000 photos on my computer, and we'll just go through them and say what we like and we'll rip it off.
You talk to the production designer too, like art department and everything?
To a degree, in terms of the color of lighting and the color contrast. I think I'm a great believer in finding a good reference. and using that to guide you, because you know you can talk till you know I can talk a lot and I don't always make a lot of sense, so I can sit there and talk with the director till the sun comes up and never really quite get to the crux of what we're talking about. Whereas if you find a photo or a still or a graphic novel or whatever it is, and you sit there with the director and say something a bit like this, and they go, yeah, something a bit like that, and then at least you know.
Do you analyze like why it is like that? Like, look at the wardrobe, look at the
location. My job, you know, I definitely work in conjunction with designers and you know wardrobe people, supervisors, rather than telling them how to do their stuff. You know, but it's definitely a sort of a collaboration with them. But for me, it all, my sort of work in color and palette, which is always to do with what color of lighting I'm doing and what the sort of the tones of that are and what the contrasts of that color are. For me, yeah, always begins a reference with the director and say, how about something like this? And then occasionally they take it to other people, and then you know, and then you start pre-production. And then you start talking to the designer and things like that. For example, I mean, you know, sometimes the production designer, you know, for example, is on equal pegging to me as a head of department. And sometimes, like, for example, in the NDFing world, we had a designer called Dick Lunn, who was absolutely amazing, brought so much to everything. But then there's a couple of things occasionally which, you know, which as a DOP you go, oh, can we do this perhaps? Or if you've got something in your head, for example, the red neons on the diner were something which I had in my head from the start. And it all sort of boiled down to a sort of an image of James in front of a diner at Blue Hour with the red neons. I don't have many ideas, but that was a sort of thing which hit me when I sort of read the script. I was like, brilliant.
And I imagine practicals and things like that you're asking. It would be great to have a practical behind him right here, right?
Absolutely. And it's something which I keep on, you know, learning from screwing up on, to be honest, is practicals. I seem to never be able to get it in my head that it is down to me as well as the designer. I always say, oh, can we get some practicals? And then they're like, oh, brilliant, great. And then it's sort of, it's never quite right. You know, as in, obviously, they look great in frame. But, you know, sort of, especially like on the end of the effing world where you rely upon the practical so much to light the space. As a DOP, you've got to be really on those practicals. You've got to know exactly. You wouldn't bring a normal light to set and, you know, the brand new Sky Panel 10,000 and you wouldn't know how to use it. And, you know, you would never put yourself in that situation. So with practicals as a DOP, I constantly don't do this quite enough, but you need to be all over the practicals. You need to be really understand what they are, where the light leaks from, what colors are the shade, you know, how can you control them, are they dimmable, can you put a normal bulb in them, you know, all these sort of things. It's not fair to, I mean, it's impossible to leave to the production designer because they're not thinking about the same things that you are. They'll be
right.
Thinking about,
they picked a cool looking lamp,
exactly, right. Totally.
Yeah. And it's flickering now when you put your camera on it.
Yeah, totally. Or it's got a little hole at the top, and as much light as it ends that way, it sends totally the opposite direction all over the ceiling or whatever.
I love that. So, while we're on the topic of collaboration, I want to dig in a tiny bit more with your relationship with the director, right? Because I think we've had, like, I was joking before, but like, this is maybe the most technical conversation we've had on the show, right? How much of these conversations, lens choices, you know, native ISO, you know, like locking your color temperature, all of that stuff that you get real nerdy on, and I'm sure you can go much, much deeper. How much of that is something that you kind of have translated your conversations with Lucy, and how much of those are like literally like you're saying numbers, getting technical basically, like, yeah. what's the balance on all that stuff?
I mean, it is different for different directors. Some directors want to be right in the technical side of things, some don't. Lucy,
do you have a preference?
I think sometimes a little knowledge can be a little bit dangerous, but a lot of knowledge is okay. So I say one of the two extremes is my preference.
You know, just enough to be dangerous, as I like,
yes,
to say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, so if a director knows just enough to, I mean, or even a lot, you know, there is always a little tiny layer of bullshit on set about what you do, so you don't always want to see straight through that. But anyway, but with that is a bit of a joke, not entirely,
and a little bit true. Yeah,
and a little
sure.
bit true.
You don't need someone to tell you how to do your job if they don't literally know how to do it.
I mean, yeah, right? Exactly, totally, exactly. And if they do literally know how to do it, then I'm happy not to be there. Yeah. Don't worry about it. It's fine. You know, it saves talking, telling me what to do.
Sure.
So with Lucy, yeah, definitely she is less technical. She is, you know, very much about performance, but she's also about, you know, sort of the angles and you know, camera movements, but she's definitely not deep into the technical side of things. You know, I think I sort of I think I, you know, I will, it's important to keep her in the loop, So it's important to, like, for example, explain our workflow with monitoring on set and what she would be seeing and what she wouldn't be seeing. But, you know, she's bloody smart, so she picked it up quite quickly, you know, and then sort of just relaxed into it. But, you know, you sort of, yeah, it's not her job to know all the ins and outs. That's, you know, that's why I'm there. But I definitely don't shy away from giving her just a once over in terms of what we're setting out to do technically.
I feel like I used to be a director that would be like, if an image looked a little too blue, I'd be like, hey, what's the white balance set to? And a lot of DPs don't really like that. They prefer you saying, like, this looks a little blue.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Lucy would probably say, yeah, what's the Y balance if there was an issue with it. I mean, obviously on this show, the answer was always the same.
Right, 50, 60.
Yeah, totally. I guess there's a lot of trust as well. And I guess that's something which when you are a long-term collaborator with somebody, you know, I trust Lucy implicitly and she trusts me, I hope, implicitly. You know, so, you know, if she says, we, you know, you got to stop playing with that light, we got to go now, I'll do it. You know, if she says it doesn't look right, I'm not going to argue with her and say, oh, it does look right, I'm going to try and find out what she, you know, she'd probably just say straight away, it's too cold. And I'd be like, okay, brilliant, I'll warm it up. You know, there's no, I would never argue against what my director wants. You know, you sometimes lobby for certain things, you know, certain bits of blocking, but...
Do you ever challenge them to try to make it better? Like, not Lucy, but other directors you've worked with saying, like, we're just going to do this two shot here. And you think it's just a boring shot.
Absolutely. But, you know, you sort of, but I think that, and over the years working directors, that comes with trust. You know, I think if a director doesn't trust you and isn't listening to you straight away, then maybe you just haven't worked with them long enough. You know, I when it comes to Lucy and me, if I say, you know, let's do this shot here, she'll generally say, yeah, okay, cool. Or if she says, no, I don't want to do that, I'll say, yeah, okay, cool. You know, and I think, you know, sort of when you've been working with someone for over a decade, that shorthand is an amazingly powerful tool to have on set.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like whenever you're working with someone new, right, like you have to learn what their priorities are and what language they speak. And I feel like oftentimes when I'm asking for a DP to compromise, I'm always on their side. I know it could be better, but also I'm responsible for the calculus of what other shots we need to get, right? And like the question for me is always like, are you gonna be a pain in the ass? Are you gonna make me feel bad about like needing to rush something or not? Because if we want to get 16 shots today and we've only got time for 15, we have to compromise somewhere. And either I'm going to feel shitty about it and we're going to compromise, or we're going to make them all as good as we possibly can and we're going to compromise. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like absolutely. It's a weird, funny thing to deal with.
In my opinion, it's a DP's job to make the day. As a DP, it is your job to be on time, be on schedule, and it's your job to push in exactly the same direction as the director, to identify how they want to work, how stuff they want to work. You know, I've done jobs where the director has spent all day on performance and my lighting turnarounds have to be instant. You know, it's a single light through the window outside, pan it one way, turn around, shoot the other way, you know, and that's not a huge amount of fun for a DP, but it's your job to get through those days. And make the show which the director wants to make. If the director wants to, you know, is happy to, you know, if you're only getting a few shots in a day, and if the director is just happy if you take time and light stuff, brilliant, do that. That's great. But really, ultimately, it's your job to make the day how the director wants, not to go shoot your show reel. Ideally, you do both. Ideally, you can somehow squeeze both out at the same time. That's a real skill. Let me know how you do that when you find out.
Yeah, I mean, right. To me, that's like when a DP knows they've kind of made it, is when the stuff they're shooting and everyone else is happy with, they're also happy with. I know we have to wrap up soon, but can you just give us a list of a couple things that directors have done that are not helpful? Like any tidbits for some newer directors, maybe you've worked with people that have always shot stuff on their own and you're the first time they're working with a DP, or they come from it, they're actors turned directors. Some tips you can give us of things to avoid.
I think one of the, you know, the things which we all strive to do is to not talk about things too much on set. I think when you're on set, that's when the clock is ticking. There is a stopwatch somewhere ticking down to when you have to wrap or when it's going to start costing production money. So, you know, any decisions, every single decision that you can make away from set, is going to save you time, and that's going to be more takes and a happier crew and better lighting and you know, better acting, whatever it is. So take every single last decision that you can and make it before the shoot day. That's a sort of big one.
Which is how rules work, right? Like, that's the brilliance of having a Bible like that. There's no question about
it. Absolutely. Yeah, it has about every single bit of looking space that you're ever going to discuss on set on a whole series for 3 months. Just get rid of all those out of the day and just say, yeah, we'll be centrally framed across the whole thing. Don't worry about it. So that's sort of a big bit of advice. I mean, in terms of working with a DP, I think do, you know, if you can, trust them. They spend their life looking at light and studying light and playing with cameras. It's your job not necessarily to tell them exactly what to do, but to give them an idea of how you want something to feel, rather than being super prescriptive. And you know, trust that they do sort of see light in their own way. Obviously, that's not all necessarily true for people who are absolutely just starting out, but maybe it is.
Right. Look at them more as a collaborator than a technician.
Absolutely. Totally. Yes.
Well, awesome. Well, I watched, I think, both seasons of End of the Fucking World, each season in one sitting.
It goes fast.
It does go fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. And really, really enjoyed how they look and how they feel and how they're performed. And they've inspired a lot of me, and hope this doesn't go to your head, but I do think if I'm talking to a director of photography and showing them some references, I might show them some stuff from your website. So don't feel bad about that, because it's, I'm sure a lot of people are referencing your stuff.
That's how it goes, man. Yeah.
It's a weird feeling. It's a weird feeling. Something getting all this attention.
Is there anything coming out soon that we should keep an eye out for?
Lucy and I's next job, I think I can talk about it. I can talk about it, is a co-production between the BBC in the UK and AMC in the States. And it is an adaptation of a book called This Is Going to Hurt, which is the diaries of a junior doctor in the National Health Service in the UK. And it's absolutely brilliant book. It's a huge, big bestseller over here. Obviously, in the UK, we love our NHS, especially during pandemic.
And that's shot already?
No, that's not shot yet. It was supposed to be shooting right now. In fact, it's supposed to just be wrapping now, in fact. But this thing happens, and we're not allowed to film dramas anymore for a little while. So it got bumped back to January. So I think that'll be starting in January. And that is, yeah, it's very exciting. It's quite sort of doctory. I would highly recommend the book. It's called This Is Going to Hurt. It's written by Adam Kay. It makes you laugh and it makes you cry, and I don't laugh or cry about anything really, and it made me laugh and cry.
Awesome. Well, before we hop into unpaid endorsements, Benedict, where can people find out more about you? Are you on social, or you got your website?
Yeah, I've got my website, benedictspence.com, and I have my snappily named Instagram, which is benedict_spence_DOP. I also have a Twitter account, benedictDOP, which I use very regularly. But yeah, please do follow me on Instagram, or have a look at my website, or message me. I try and be quite engaged with people online, especially during pandemic. I think it's
and
important.
You have a podcast that you're not quite so active on anymore, but if listeners wanted to check out your podcast,
yeah, it's called Tailslate. I think it's tailslate.fm, and it's also on Apple Podcasts somewhere.
That makes sense. No wonder you've forgotten to keep doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we're gonna name it later after the fact.
Oh man, jumping on each other's jokes. Doing this too long.
Great.
Well, Benedict, can you hop into unpaid endorsements with us?
Yes, why not?
Unpaid endorsements. So I've got two endorsements. They're both media related. I'll start with the one that people haven't seen. It's a short film called The Voice in Your Head. It was on Short of the Week. We'll go ahead and tweet it out. It's really great. It's a fun comedy about, you know, the personification of the voice in your head of like negative feelings, basically. So a person who has a man kind of following him around, you know, telling him to like walk like a normal person, like why are you so stupid, why are you doing that, kind of just like hounding him all the time, but with a fun twist that I won't give away, but takes what's a kind of familiar sort of trope and like twists it on its head in a way that's really fun. And also the camera work and the stage direction, everything about it is really well executed. So it's I think a really good example of a short that takes something familiar and just executes it at a really premium level. I think it was at South by this last year and is now up on Short of the Week.
What's it called?
It's called The Voice in Your Head. And then my other endorsement is obvious to everyone except for me, The Last Dance, which was the Jordan documentary that was on
Matt,
ESPN.
Come on.
And is now on Netflix. I told
doesn't
you.
Doesn't even need an endorsement.
It's so good. Here's the actual endorsement. I could not care less about sports. I can't name the last time I watched a game of any sort, including the Super Bowl. I don't know the last time I saw a sports game telecast. And I have loved The Last Dance. So just because you don't care about putting balls in hoops or over gold lines or whatever, the human drama and the pathos of that documentary is top notch. Really great.
I concur on that one. I think it's brilliant. Yeah, it's a great talk.
Yeah. Yeah, that voice in your head reminds me of this amazing progressive insurance campaign that's going on right now, where it's this guy who's like trying to get people to be less like their parents. Have you seen?
Oh man, that campaign is so good. Yeah.
It's like this guy's reading a book about submarines, and he's like, the coach is like, who reads books about submarines? The guy says, my father. Yeah. Yeah. Stop doing that. Anyhow. Okay. Benedict, you got anything?
I'll do two as well. One's very quick, just to repeat what I said before, which is I know this much is true, which is on HBO, I do believe. And it is it's Mark Ruffalo playing himself and his twin. And it is incredibly dark. It is so dark. It leaves me feeling so sad. But it is a filmmaking, it's beautiful, wonderful filmmaking. It is really, really, really good. I'm only halfway through the series, but yeah, I would highly recommend that. And then the other one is any science fiction book by Ian M. Banks. Ian M. Banks is a writer, and he's dead now, unfortunately. Once you read his sci-fi, you can never ever read any other sci-fi ever again without getting horribly bored. But unfortunately, last week it was announced that the Amazon series of his collected culture books is been cancelled because his estate wasn't happy with it or something like that. But honestly, I can't tell you how amazingly written they are. As a sci-fi fan, I reread them all the time. They're absolutely brilliant. They are so imaginative, it's unreal. Without being geeky and weird, they're just amazing books. So I'd highly recommend that if anybody's into sci-fi, the Ian M. Banks culture series. So it's about a sort of a future space culture, enormous, you know, billions upon billions of people, and they rely upon sort of AIs and machines and spaceships, and their spaceships have all got weird names, but it's brilliant.
Okay, I'll go. I'll also do two. One real quick. I think a lot of people know this is a great documentary, but Speed Cubers. Have you guys seen that one?
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
It's really short. It's like 40 minutes. It's on Netflix, and it's about solving the Rubik's Cube. And these basically the world champion Rubik's Cube solver gets dethroned by this autistic kid from California. The world champion is Australian.
And they're kind of two of the greatest of all time, basically.
Yeah. And pretty much all the greatest of all times Rubik's Cube solvers are kids, because once you become an adult, you're not practicing, you know, 20 hours a day anymore. But it's really moving. It's really touching. I personally was a Rubik's Cube person.
Sub 10, Oren? Sub 5? How fast did you go?
I could very consistently do sub 3 minutes. In the documentary, they are talking about seconds, you know, solving it like with one
three
hand.
3 minutes
less
is still pretty
seconds.
Fast. Yeah, when you watch them do it one-handed, it looks like someone's just pretending to solve a cube.
Yeah.
But then it's done.
It's crazy.
Seconds.
I thought one of the interesting rules is when you mark that you're done solving the cube, if you missed like your last move or your last two moves, you still get the credit, but they add a second for each move you missed. So if you solved it in 7 seconds, but you needed two more twists, you get a 9 second.
Also, I noticed a technicality where because they solve it and then they slap their hands on the table. But if the final move, it has to be within 45 degrees of being squared up. So like even it can be kind of perfect, but if it's not completely twisted into place.
Yeah. That's when you get one of those penalties.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then my other thing is kind of on the same note of if you don't like sports, you will like Save the Last Dance. Well, if you don't like camping, you will like this place that I just went camping at. It's called El Capitan. It's in Santa Barbara, and it's just like the most fun place to go, especially if you have kids and stuff and you don't like pitching tents and sleeping in dirt and all that stuff. You get a log cabin. It's got electricity and a whole bathroom and everything. But you're in nature. And when we were two nights ago, we were like, you know, grilling. You grill your own food, but you just order like a grill kit and they drive it to you. They deliver it to you with like a, you know, valet type guy. And it's got like the salmon pre-marinated, like wrapped in tin foil. They give you the logs with the fire starter. They're like, just put this here and like light it on fire. Put the salmon on here for 2 minutes, flip it over. It's like Blue Apron, but you're in nature. But there are actual animals. While we were there, we saw all trying to get our food, skunks, raccoons. We saw two foxes come by. And we saw,
how did they taste?
Deer. We didn't eat them, but we were trying to get the skunks away. So we had these chips. They're called Paqui chips, P-A-Q-U-I. They make some of the spiciest chips in the world. Like they're literal competitions to see who can eat an entire chip without like throwing up. And we had a few. So we're like, oh, we'll just sprinkle these chips on the ground. And then one skunk will eat one and they'll never come back.
Yeah, give a skunk diarrhea. That's a good plan, Oren.
Well, anyway, 5 minutes later, like every animal in the forest came to get these chips. They loved them. And literally, our friend Bramley, who was in one of the cabins, she said that she was in the cabin and a raccoon was like literally knocking on her window. Like, so I guess nature animals like really, really, really spicy chips. But El Capitan, it's just an awesome place to go with your family. They have a pool and a playground and walking distance to the beach and all these things that were closed due to COVID, but it was fun nonetheless.
Well, Benedict, this was great. Let us know the next time you have a project you want to come talk to us about.
Yeah, this is so awesome. Thanks. I think people are really going to love this.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, man. This episode was edited by Sarah Weirda, and this episode was produced by Sarah Weirda as well. Our new social media manager is Derek Aiello, and you can follow me at Mr. Matt Enlow across all social media, and you can follow the show at Just Shoot It Pod.
Our webmaster is Ewan Williams, and you can follow me on Instagram at O'Kaplan. On Twitter, I'm at Smitey Pyleg. And we will catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.